So, Aaron and Scott, the fact that we are finally here, we've basically made it past the primaries, we are in campaign mode. I'm curious for you guys, since this is kind of like your Olympics, is there anything that you do to prepare for this moment in the campaign? Like, are you waking up every morning playing like the Rocky theme song, or like you got like the protein shakes out to sort of like beef up for November? What do you do?
I find it's a really slow build. I don't really start the protein shakes in the morning and all that stuff until the conventions. Like, I'm interested in it now, but like we're a little ways away from like the I'm going to hit this thing really hard, I think.
Yeah, it's a long campaign. But we are still in the zombie primary days, so I'm still got some late Tuesday nights tracking some congressional seats. And
I like the name zombie primary period. Maybe that's going to be the name of my playlist for this part of campaign season. So today is March 15th, 2024, and it is a Friday. And so we are here with the Campaign Moment, our weekly conversation on Post Reports about all things politics. Today, of course, we have senior political reporter Aaron Blake, author of the Campaign Moment newsletter. Aaron, hello.
Good morning.
And our guest today is Scott Clement, the polling director for The Washington Post. Scott, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
So quite a few big things happened this week. Of course, we had the Georgia primary, among other primaries. We have this critical moment where Biden and Trump have both collected enough delegates at this point that they are the nominees. We have more fallout from the State of the Union and from the special counsel Robert Hur testimony. We're going to talk about all those things today. But before we get there, Scott, I just want to talk to you a little bit about your job, because I think regular people will hear the polling director at the Washington Post and they'll be like, what exactly does that person do? So just explain to me, what do you do and how do polls figure into your work?
So my job as the polling director of the Post is to help the Post conduct independent scientific polls of any group that they're interested in. You know, you want to know what people are thinking. There's classic ways to go report that, go on the street, talk to people, hold a microphone to people's mouth, things like that. Polling is that at scale. So it's just reporting at scale, trying to think, how can we draw a representative scientific sample of a group and ask them the same questions and measure it in a consistent way and then report it fairly? That's essentially what I do for the Post.
I think a lot of people don't really trust polls, or sometimes don't think that polls are important, right? That they're all about the horse race and they're not like really getting at the issues that people care about. What would you say to that about why polls do actually matter and are something to pay attention to?
Well, certainly there have been some high-profile misses in elections recently. 2020 and 2016, polls overall underestimated Donald Trump's support. And, you know, in high-stakes events like that, they're going to get very heavily scrutinized. We don't see a lot of coverage, of course, when polls do well. They did well in 2022, 2018. It's not to say that you should accept and not get better. Polls are constantly trying to get better, prove more representative samples, get more representative samples. But essentially, my guidance is to take polls with a grain of salt. If you add 3 points one way or the other, think about how that would change your conclusion. And if you see a really interesting poll result, look around, see if there's something else. Is this the only poll showing that? That might be a sign that it's an outlier, or that you just need more data to really figure out what the truth is.
And if I could cut in and
yeah, go for
and,
it.
And defend Scott's industry, which I value greatly and use a lot. A big reason the polls get a bad rap is when the results are a few points different. So, you know, Hillary Clinton is going to win the 2016 presidential campaign and then Donald Trump wins. It's an error of a few percentage points. I think you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, though. What we're going to be, I think, focusing a lot today on is how certain groups are viewing the campaign. Mm-hmm. Things can be off by a few percentage points and that changes the result. But you can also look at these issues and get a sense for where the American people are with a pretty good degree of accuracy without necessarily predicting a race. And so I think polls are valuable in that way.
So, Scott, what we have been doing every week is talking about what we think is the campaign moment of the week. And I have a guess as to what your campaign moment will be, but I'm curious. What do you think was the big moment of this week?
The biggest campaign moment for me this week, as much as it was expected, was President Biden and Donald Trump winning their party's nominations for president. It was long likely to happen, and it means that we are now officially in the general election. There's no more serious primary challenges. There may be third party candidates, but that was the big one for me.
Yeah, and for me, it's a chance to look more earnestly at the general election, which we've been doing a little bit before, but now we can start to break these things down and these questions will start to get focused in Americans' minds a little bit more now that, you know, Republicans aren't, you know, thinking about Nikki Haley and Democrats aren't thinking about, you know, what's happening in the Republican primary.
What did you make of the drop-off in Nikki Haley voters in terms of what we should make of this question of where the Haley voters are going to go from here?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I would recommend to people a story that my colleagues Philip Bump and Lenny Bronner did, which basically looked at the 80,000 people who voted for Nikki Haley in Georgia. She got, I believe it was 13% of the vote, which is less than she had gotten before, but is still a substantial number of people who are not voting for Donald Trump. Nikki Haley is no longer a candidate now, so those people are voting for a non-candidate, essentially. But what we saw when we dug into the results was that a lot of these people had voted early, and the early voting period took place largely when she was still in the race. She won just 7% of the election day voters. And then we had this analysis from my colleagues that showed that a large number of these voters who voted for Haley, about one quarter of them, were actually people who voted in the 2020 Democratic primary. So a big question has always been, how many of these people are actually gettable voters for Donald Trump versus people who are coming out to cast a protest vote in some of these open primaries? And this suggests that there was a substantial number of people who probably weren't really Trump voters or potential Trump voters in the first place.
Hmm. So that seems like one of the big questions going forward is like how many of those people are gettable. But Aaron, I know that you have been kind of framing out these like critical factors that are going to affect how things shape up for the remainder of the race. You wrote the story about how there are some clear X factors, which I both love that phrase. And then I was like, isn't that a TV show, or is it X Factor, or is it Fear Factors? Are these like the fear factors of the 2024 race?
It's interesting. That's your cultural reference. My cultural reference for X Factors is the old Lauryn Hill song, but I guess that's the difference between the two of us, and maybe that's a generational thing.
I'm also deeply embarrassed that I don't know what song you're talking about, and I feel like that reflects extremely poorly on me. Wait, so, sorry, the song is X Factor?
EX Factor.
Oh, EX Factor.
Like your ex that you, you know, are remembering.
Oh, it's this one. Loving you is like a battle. I'm listening to it on Spotify now. I do know this song.
Trump is very much the X Factor for American, for 2024 presidential election.
I missed that. Finally, Martine gets one of my cultural references. This makes me feel younger now.
Okay, anyways, back to X factors and how these various issues might affect the 2024 race as it stands going forward. Aaron, what was on your list of what we should be paying attention to?
So a few things that I'm looking forward, and these are the things that I think are going to go a long ways towards determining who wins the 2024 election. One is the potential shift in non-white voters, the idea that they could shift more towards Republicans than they have in the past. Another is kind of twin and related questions with Donald Trump, which is, one, people right now like him more than they did when he was president. Does that continue? And mm-hmm. two, you know, how much do people care about some of the things that he's saying that tend in a more authoritarian direction?
And let's talk a little bit about that for a second, because I think Obviously these are important things to note. I mean, tell me about what Trump has been saying that may or may not be getting people's attention on the, like, will he become a dictator front?
Yeah, so he had the quip about, you know, I would be a dictator, but only for one day.
Under no circumstances, you are promising America tonight, you would never abuse power as retribution against anybody.
Except for day one.
He's talking about pardoning many January 6th defendants. He's talking about going after his allies, you know, directly ordering his Justice Department to pursue people in a way that, you know, he'll say that I'm just doing this because they're doing it. But there's no evidence that President Biden is pushing for these prosecutions of Donald Trump and his allies. A lot of things that are really, you know, have been beyond the pale in the past. And I think a question is, number one, how much are people aware of those things? And there's some polling that suggests that people haven't really processed these things. And then the second question, of course, is how much do they care? There is a large shift in the Republican Party towards saying some of these things are okay, saying that a president breaking some rules and laws is necessary because of the times we're in. But, you know, whether that plays with more middle-of-the-road voters, how much they're going to be kind of turned off by some of these very extreme proposals, I think is a very valid question.
And also feels sort of absurd to be asking this question, right? Like, how much do Americans, like, pay attention to or care about the potential for an authoritarian leader? But, Scott, I'm curious if when we talk about the polling around that and how people are actually thinking about and processing what Trump is saying along these lines or, like, this perceived threat, how much are people actually paying attention?
Well, I don't think as much as when the events were actually happening. And certainly not as much as when Trump was president. That's a big question, is how much of those more really unpopular and extreme things that Trump did are baked into what people think right now about the presidential race? Or would people vote differently or think about him differently if reminded of those kind of things in a campaign, which the campaign will do? So I think that's a big question. And I don't know the answer. I think polls provide some clues that certainly things look better for Trump than you might expect, given the kind of rejection of January 6th that we saw.
Yeah, and I think another key point there is I doubt that people have processed a lot of these things. We have some polling to back that up. There was a survey from a Democratic pollster this week that showed basically 3 in 10 kind of gettable voters for President Biden. I have heard a lot about some of these more authoritarian proposals. But also, some of this is kind of baked in. There was a CNN poll recently, and I think I brought this up on the podcast before, which showed that 63% of registered voters described Trump as too extreme. But he still led President Biden in the head-to-head matchup. So, you know, maybe people aren't as interested in these things. They kind of view them as part of who Trump is. But it'll be incumbent upon Democrats to kind of drive these things home over the next 8 months.
And what we're not talking about here, I think, is Biden's own popularity. I mean, and just backing up to, I mean, the point Aaron made about question about non-white voters. I mean, we've got a president who's really unpopular, and you write that off, come up with different reasons for it. You know, maybe it will change, and that's true, but that's a huge thing. It's common for people to judge and make their presidential choice based on their views of the current president. And that's Biden. And so, you know, if Biden were a, you know, 60% approval president, people might not have any trouble rejecting Trump and comparing, but they don't like Biden or Trump.
I want to talk more about the non-white voters question, because I found this really interesting and, frankly, very surprising. The shift that you have both in Black and Hispanic voters potentially toward Trump. Can you talk a little bit about, like, what the numbers are that you're actually seeing there, and how much is this shift, like, a real thing?
So according to the Pew validated voter data from the 2016 and 2020 elections, Donald Trump got 6% of the Black vote in 2016 and 8% in 2020. What we're seeing in early polls is that sometimes he gets twice as much support as those elections. Sometimes he gets as much as 3 times as much. And this is a significant thing. If it were anywhere close to that, it would be a significant dilution of President Biden's base, losing those voters, which have been so solidly Democratic for decades now. If that were to change, that would be a significant change in our electorate. But I do think there are reasons to be skeptical that we would see such a major quick realignment in such a substantial portion of the electorate as well.
This is a classic case where there's an accumulation of data showing Trump doing better than expected among Black voters. I think that's the big picture of this, how much that depends a little on the data source and how much we can really make apples to apples comparisons to past data sources. That's a little tough too. When some sources do show a shift in the party leanings, Gallup has found that of Black Americans as well as Latino Americans in recent years in the Republican direction. So that's a sign as well. One thing, just non-horse race side, which I think informs this, is a January Pew poll found 48% of Black Americans approve of Biden's job performance. That is a far cry from the roughly 90% who supported him in 2020. So when you have that kind of dissatisfaction among a core group who supported Biden, not only in the general election and Democrats historically, but in the primaries in 2020, there's all kinds of things that could happen and need to happen in order for him to achieve that same level of support in the general election. Not only do people need to decide that it's better to vote for Biden than Trump, but people have to be convinced that it's worth it to vote, that it's really not just a choice between people they don't like, but maybe something that they really want to achieve. Those are big things that need to be resolved over the next 6 months. And I think Democrats and Biden administration are probably hopeful they can do that. But as of right now, it's not resolved. And there's quite a lot of questions about turnout as well as vote preference among Black voters.
But why is there this shift? What specifically is it that either Black voters or Hispanic voters are feeling in this moment that is causing this, it sounds like, almost disproportionate shift?
I think it's clear that the Hispanic vote has been shifting towards Republicans for years now. You know, it's not been a steady shift, but the general trajectory is towards Republicans more than it was, you know, a decade or two ago. As far as Black voters, there is some indication that this is Black voters who identify as conservative, and those voters have always been there, but they generally voted for Democrats. Maybe they don't do that as much as they did before. You know, to hear Donald Trump talk about this.
I mean, he has said some wild things, right? That, like, what was his quote from South Carolina last month?
The mugshot, we've all seen the mugshot. And you know who embraced it more than anybody else? The Black population. It's incredible. You see Black people walking around with my mugshot.
Like, there's some sort of, like, shared experience of being overly criminalized. It's very shocking rhetoric you're hearing from him.
And I think that these shifts predated his indictments in a lot of ways. So I don't know how serious he is about that. I think he likes to say things like that because they get attention. But, you know, it is something that's happening. I don't think that we've gotten huge data sets of polls that are focused only on this population that can allow us to draw too many conclusions. But I would expect in the next 8 months that that's going to be a focus for people like Scott to really drill down on.
Well, most definitely will. This is a classic area where I think polls bring some value, which is, you know, when you see a surprising result in maybe a subgroup or something like that, it's a call for pollsters to conduct more detailed surveys, asking different questions to try to get to the heart of the issue. One big poll we did last year of more than 1,200 Black Americans nationally, we asked people if they thought Biden's policies had helped or hurt Black people or hadn't made a difference. And 49% of Black Americans said they hadn't made a difference. 34% said they had helped. You know, there's a lot of reasons or potential reasons for some shifts, but that's one that stuck with me as far as people not necessarily seeing a big impact of his presidency.
All right, so let's take a pause there. And after the break, we're going to talk more about the news from the last week and also news from today when it comes to the Georgia case against Donald Trump. We'll be right back. All right, so there's more to talk about from some of the campaign news that we've had from this past week. But I do think that we should actually mention the news that just broke, what, like a couple minutes before we sat down here, which is a determination by the judge who's looking at the Georgia case against Trump and the question of whether District Attorney Fani Willis should be a part of this case going forward. Aaron, what's the news here and how does this affect what's going to be going on in this trial going forward?
Yeah, so basically this is something that's kind of taken over the Georgia case for a couple of weeks now. And the issue was whether Fani Willis's relationship with the prosecutor that she hired to handle the case was a conflict of interest. The court found that there was no conflict of interest, but he did find quote, the prosecution is encumbered by the appearance of impropriety.
What does that mean?
Basically that these people were in a relationship. There were questions about whether this relationship predated when he was hired, and so whether that hiring was proper. The argument from the allies of Donald Trump was that this prosecutor paid for vacations with the money that he received from this job, so that there's something kind of ugly going on there. But the upshot of the case is that the judge said Fani Willis can stay on this case, her team can stay on this case, they're not disqualified, but that either they or Nathan Wade, the prosecutor, have to go. And I think it's a pretty easy call from there that Nathan Wade would be the one to go, because otherwise this whole thing would be thrown into disarray. But I do think it's important that there was, that the ruling is that there was no actual conflict of interest. It's basically just something that they need to take care of because people are going to look at this and, you know, view it as potentially suspect.
So now that this stage of things is over and we have an answer to this question of whether Fani Willis will be able to continue prosecuting this case, what does that actually mean for the case itself, this question of whether Donald Trump illegally tried to interfere with the election in Georgia? Is that going to go forward? How soon are we going to see that actually go to trial?
It's the million-dollar question. You know, all of these cases, the question is when we're going to actually see a trial and whether that will be before the election or if we'll see it at all, because in some of these cases, you know, Trump could potentially try to pardon himself if he wins. This case is a very complex one. When you're talking about racketeering cases, there's generally a couple of years before they actually go to trial. We don't know what the situation here is going to be. This would at least open the door to this continuing to move forward and potentially be handled before the election, but I don't know anybody that's necessarily expecting that. And so as far as things that have a bearing on the election, I don't know that this is at the top of the list right now.
And of course, you know, this trial and the other trials against Trump come back to that X factor that you were talking about when it comes to Trump's authoritarianism slash like Trump's standing to be president. But I want to talk about some of the other X factors that you also dove into as well. And coming back to that question of age, which I know that we've talked about a ton, but it does seem like since the State of the Union, the Biden campaign has had this narrative of like, yes, Biden was out there. He was active. He was loud. He's with it. Now that we are a week out from the State of the Union, is that narrative like being picked up by regular people? Like, has the State of the Union moved the ball at all for Biden and for Democrats in terms of making people feel more comfortable with the age question?
In short, it does not appear so at this point. This week, we got a poll from Yahoo News and YouGov that tested many of these age questions. And this was a poll after the State of the Union. And it found that things were basically unchanged. 29% of people only said that Biden was fit to serve another term. 51% said that his age was still a big problem. Both of those were exactly the same as they were in January, basically. And then I think this is the question that really gets at this, at the kind of key State of the Union question, which is people who watched it, they were asked if Biden seemed, quote, not as old as they expected. And just 17% of people said that. So I don't think this has changed the game.
Were you guys surprised by the reaction from people?
Well, I mean, a good night for Biden is not a good full campaign for Biden. So I think it can be both a positive speech for him, maybe one of his better moments, maybe one of the times that he'd like to repeat or his campaign would like him to repeat. But you're talking about a perception that's built up over many, many months, really years. And so it's going to take more to shake that. And it's also one, you know, you can also be more vibrant, but also still look or seem old. So, you know, the big question that I've been paying attention to in polls, and I haven't seen a great deal of it since the State of the Union, are this questions of mental fitness or mental stamina. That's the sort of, I think, real heart of the age question to me is not whether you look old or feel old, but just whether it's going to impact your ability to do the job or whether you're incompetent. That's the kind of stuff that hits really home. And I think that may be one, you know, if Biden's out giving those kind of speeches consistently or engaging, he has more of a hope of shifting those type of perceptions.
Well, of course, those were also the questions that came up this week when it came to the congressional testimony of special counsel Robert Hur, which I found very fascinating to watch. So for people who might not remember from the eons ago, that was basically last month. This was the report that came out from a special counsel basically saying that they're not going to be prosecuting President Biden for having classified documents at his house, but that the reason for that was in part because he's just like so old and has such a bad memory that no one would think that he had done a criminal act anyways. But it was interesting because when we originally heard about the special counsel's kind of determination on that, it really made it sound like Biden was misremembering, like, in profound ways. That he couldn't recall the year that his son died, that there were, like, huge gaps in his memory. And in part of this testimony this week, we actually saw the transcript from the special counsel's interview with President Biden, in which it felt more muddy, right? But I don't know, did you guys have the same reaction that this was somewhat of a vindicating moment for Biden?
I think the transcript was helpful in a couple of ways because it did, you know, allow us to kind of consume how this was cast. I kept thinking back to how then Attorney General William Barr kind of pre-spun the special counsel's report from Robert Mueller about the Russia investigation in ways that turned out to be pretty misleading. I think in this case, not as much. People are keying on Biden citing the actual date that Beau Biden died, May 30th, and basically suggesting that Robert Hur had gotten this wrong. The key there was that Biden was talking about the year 2017, and then he brought up his son's death. And Robert Hur was basically saying, no, that was in 2015. That was years before. So the timeline doesn't match up. So I think that was oversold as kind of something that Robert Hur got wrong. The other thing that I think was really interesting from the transcript was, and this is maybe more to the argument that Robert Hur kind of exaggerated things, is that he talked about how President Biden had not remembered that a certain official in the administration had also wanted to pull out of Afghanistan. It turned out later in that interview, Biden actually correctly summarized this very same official's posture on that. And so it was very muddled when it was first brought up. And so I think in that case, it looked a little bit more like this was read a little bit too much into by her in his report.
I mean, this is an important report. It was an important transcript. I think the transcript, had it been part of the conversation immediately when the report came out, might have shaped coverage a little differently. And given the importance of perceptions of Biden's mental acuity, it's all very high stakes. It's also still March. You know, there's time for things to take shape in this campaign. But it was a window, I think, to me in, you know, how much, you know, seeing the full transcript really tells a deeper story about where Biden's at. And also, I mean, there's a reason why it got a lot of attention. It's been a big question of where Biden's at. And this was a very plain accusation that he was not with it. So it says something about the need to really get everything as quickly as possible in interpreting this, but also for voters. And for voters, I doubt they were watching the hearings that closely or maybe even reading the details of the report, but they're reading the headlines that come from those. And that's important.
I think it's a good point to ask of like how much are, you know, regular Americans, quote unquote, like reading the headlines on this versus like watching this testimony, following like anything that the special counsel is doing, like does this matter in their understanding of Biden's age at all? But I will point out that we started to see this week ads from Biden's campaign where he has started to like talk about the age stuff in this very direct way. We can listen to a little clip of that.
Look, I'm not a young guy. That's no secret. But here's the deal. I understand how to get things done for the American people. I led the country through the COVID crisis. Today, we have the strongest economy in the world.
Yeah, and we saw this in the State of the Union address last week as well, where he closed with a riff on his age.
In my career, I've been told I was too young. By the way, they didn't let me on the Senate elevators for votes sometimes. Not a joke. And I've been told I'm too old. Whether young or old, I've always known what endures. I've known our North Star.
You know, both of these are an acknowledgement that this is a very real issue for him. They need to take this head on. They can't just ignore it and dismiss it as some kind of a media construct. We don't know whether that's working right now. We haven't seen a shift on the age or mental acuity issues in the polls, but it's very early. We've been tuning into this potential general election for a while now. A lot of Americans haven't. But now that it's at an actual matchup, I think we're going to start to see some kind of perception solidified and potentially shift a little bit more.
Yeah, as Scott said, I guess we're still in the zombie phase here. So maybe it's premature
Now we're in the zombie general election phase.
What I'm wondering is whether Biden can fight back to be not seen as too old to be president. He doesn't need to fight to be seen young. You know, personal attributes don't always rank the highest in the kind of things people want out of a president. They want policies they want. They care deeply about a whole bunch of issues and stakes and all kinds of things. We see this in poll after poll. And, you know, these personal attributes, whether they are, you know, people's age, gender, religion, they do matter. But they're really secondary unless it seems to get in the way of issue one, whether you can do the job, incompetence. So that part, I imagine Biden is going to really try to fight back against the claims that he's really too old to do the job. And if he can do that, he's got months to do it. There are plenty of his supporters, and of course, he won the majority in 2020, who would be willing to give him another chance if he can just sort of overcome those kind of basic qualification elements.
That seems like the question going forward. Look, I think we are out of time, so we're going to leave it there. But thank you both so much for being here. Again, Scott Clement, the polling director for The Post, and Aaron Blake, senior political reporter and author of the Campaign Moment newsletter. Thank you guys both so much.
Thanks, Martine.
Thanks, Martine.
Remember to subscribe to Aaron's newsletter, which you can do by looking for a link in today's show notes or at postreports.com. If you have not yet signed up, the Campaign Moment is a great way to stay on top of what's latest in politics and be caught up with all of Aaron's great insights. That's it for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. Today's show was produced and mixed by Ted Muldoon. It was edited by Renita Jablonski. And the rest of the Post Reports team includes Maggie Penman, Rena Flores, Lucy Perkins, Monica Campbell, Alana Gordon, Ariel Plotnick, Bishop Sand, Renny Svernovsky, Sabi Robinson, Emma Talkoff, Sean Carter, Peter Bresnan, Allison Michaels, and Alahe Azadi. And I am Martine Powers. We'll be back on Monday with more stories from The Washington Post.